Well, there are a few scholars of science, social studies of science, who say the same exact thing, that there is this huge reluctance and to overthrow these paradigms of thought. And I guess my question to you is, why was it that you were, more than so than somebody else, was willing to throw out these old notions that, you know, could this be a new strain of E. coli doing this, or what was it about, you know, your ideas or your background that allowed you to come up with this new theory or new discovery?
Well, you know, it wasn't really a new theory or a discovery. It was really, you know, just using the traditional epidemiological approach, I found, you know, association with this particular pathogen to be the agent of this particular disease. You know, it was just a standard way to, how do you decide that, you know, a particular agent is a causative agent of a particular disease? And there are certain, you know, criteria that you follow. You know, the most famous example is the Koch's postulate. We can't do Koch's postulate in this setting, you know. So what do you do? So you do what I call an epidemiologic Koch's postulate. You first do a case control study, identify an association. You know, it's only an association of an illness with a particular, you know, organism. And then, so that sort of establishes one hypothesis. Then you have to do a prospective study, a prospectively designed study. And if that prospective study confirms or points to the same organism, then I would say that's the proof of, you know, the epidemiological Koch's postulate. And so that's what I did. Now, it also, from a biology point of view, then you have to show what the mechanism of the production of this bloody diarrhea is when they get infected with this E. coli. So those were then the series of studies that got started. And it turns out, you know, this particular E. coli has a phage, a converting phage, which produces a certain type of toxin. But the E. coli itself is not that different from another class of E. coli associated diarrhea called enteropathogenic E. coli, which I happen to be working on also, which I worked on later. And so the combination of this host, E. coli, with this new virus converted into a completely new pathogen, or at least an organism that was capable of causing a completely different type of disease. So there is an explanation. But you couldn't get to that point until the epidemiology was done. You know, the epidemiology helped pinpoint that this is an organism to work with, and now you have to understand what the mechanism is. And so, you know, there would have been no discoveries made about this converting phage and about the mechanism of the production diarrhea without the epidemiological work that was done. And so, you know, there was nothing about my background that helped make that discovery. It was just that I happened to be an EIS officer doing what I was supposed to be doing. I was in the right place at the right time, you know, for an unusual outbreak. At least at that time, an unusual outbreak. You know, I was very lucky to have had an opportunity, you know, to investigate and have the laboratory backup at CDC, which really went through the stool samples to isolate all these organisms. And, you know, Joy Wells was sort of the person who really sort of, you know, orchestrated the whole laboratory aspect of it. And that's what makes CDC so strong, that epidemiology and laboratories are so intimately linked, and there's just not very many other institutions like that in the world, you know, that can do that. You know. But, you know, I'm also, you know, I mean, later on I came to the realization the power of epidemiology in understanding pathogenesis, which is the research, the basic research that I do now, and that, you know, if you just do pathogenesis at the bench side, from the microbiology point of view, you know, you might make some interesting discoveries, but I'm not sure if those discoveries are going to make a big impact.
Yeah. Okay. And I guess to pursue this area of where's the connection between your kind of classical epidemiological experience or expertise and kind kind of the revolution of molecular biology, mm-hmm. kind of, where is this connection? To start off, I guess I'd like to ask, you know, how aware were you of the revolution in molecular biology and keeping up with literature, say, mm-hmm. in more of a basic science field? We knew of bacteria in terms of coming from a molecular biology perspective. We knew of the role of bacteria in creating this revolution mm-hmm. and how it made pretty much made virology, made new techniques possible.
Sure.
But now you're turning them and looking at bacteria.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, even I guess when I was at CDC, a lot of those things were new, even in the
right.
molecular biology field. And so certainly when I was at CDC, I didn't really keep up with, you know, any of the molecular biology literature. And, you know, I didn't read Science or Nature, those kind of journals. It really wasn't until my fellowship, you know, I started getting into it. And in fellowship, I went to Stanford with an idea of just learning molecular techniques to really apply for epidemiology, you know, to apply them to epidemiology. So my plan wasn't really to really get very much in depth into the fundamental, you know, molecular biology, you know, of anything. But I ended up getting hooked by that. I started working with enteropathogenic E. coli, which is a major cause of infantile diarrhea in Brazil. And I ended up working in Gary Skulnick's lab. And so I actually brought all the EPEC strains with me from CDC to work on this. And Gary was working with the enterotoxinic E. coli, another E. coli. So it was natural for me to, you know, work on an E. coli project. And I was interested in looking at the mechanism of attachment of this E. coli. It has a very interesting pattern of attachment with HeLa cells. So we're trying to clone whatever bacteria factors there were that facilitated this association. And the idea being that if we can identify, you know, such a factor, then we can maybe develop a new diagnostic, you know, test for EPEC, so I can take it back to the field in Brazil to identify the sequence. Because, you know, you have to, you know, all these E. coli, most of the E. coli are, you know, they're non-pathogenic, right? They're in the intestine. So how do you distinguish non-pathogenic E. coli from a particular type of diarrheogenic E. coli? And how do you distinguish enteropathogenic E. coli from enterotoxinic E. coli, which is also very common in Brazil? Those are the big issues, you know, in epidemiology at that time, in E. coli diarrheal diseases. So I wanted to clone something that was specific for EPEC, and then use that as a, you know, a molecular diagnostic tool. You know, Stan Falco had already identified a way to detect enterotoxinic E. coli by, you know, identifying the gene responsible for the LT and ST toxins. So Steve Mosley, you know, looked at some strains from Thailand, enterotoxinic strains from Thailand. They were able to distinguish by the way it hybridized with this probe that specifically recognized these virulence genes, you know, the LT, the so-called heat labile toxin gene and heat stable toxin gene. Well, we have to have the same sort of tool for EPEC, and because EPEC was a major cause of mortality in infants in Brazil and other urban centers of developing countries. So I wanted to do something that was, you know, identify something that was very specific for EPEC. So that was just, but, you know, it became more and more of a pathogenesis project, you know, as I got more and more into it and became more interested in the pathogenesis question more than trying to just come up with a diagnostic tool.
And did that interest in pathogenesis develop at the CDC?
Or no, it was at Stanford, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was really at Stanford.
And in terms of the kinds of molecular techniques you were using at the CDC, you know, you have this problem, this epidemiological problem, and you have all these techniques out there that could send epidemiology further along,
right.
Push the barriers of the current knowledge. And how was it that you choose the methods you choose, the RFLP techniques, and... is it a matter of, you know, having this epidemiological problem, you have this case, design this case study, and here are all these things, and we'll just kind of pick one that works, or is it the other way around? Were you looking at kind of the intellectual development of molecular biology techniques and saying, okay, this is going to work here, or... Did you know what an RFLP was?
Sure. No, I mean, you know, that we were using
how
it.
This?
Well, no, you know there are techniques that are that come up, and somebody at CDC, you know, especially the lab people, were much more on top of those, you know, okay, newly introduced techniques, and they would actually start applying them themselves for their own pathogens.
Okay.
And then, you know, we would learn about those and say, you know, can we try that in any, you know, in enteric pathogens?
Okay.
And so, you know, we started with plasmid profile and RFLP and, you know, phage typing. I guess that had already been there before. But then you try and see, you know, if they're actually really helpful. You know, some of the techniques are not helpful, or some of the techniques are just too complicated to be, you know, really practical. You know, my interest was also, you know, application of these techniques in the field in developing countries. So we have to keep it really simple and doable. And so, you know, that was my motivation in trying to, you know, come up, trying to look for the appropriate techniques. So it's a, you know, it's a gradual discovery process in sort of empirical trial and error, you know, manner. But I sort of got away from that when I was at Stanford. So, you know, I was really heavily getting into pathogenesis.
And were you aware of PCR techniques at the CDC, or was
they didn't have it at the time? That wasn't discovered till as I was leaving Stanford,
it's like 1988. Okay,
yeah. No, I mean, the, you know, the technique was, you know, earlier,
right,
but nobody started really applying it till like in the late 80s. And so when I left Stanford, we were actually the first ones to do PCR on enteric pathogens. We actually did it by hand, you know, from water bath to water bath at the time.
And again, what was driving this? Was to go, okay, well, let's see if we can use this new technique, PCR, in our work?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, again, it's a gradual discovery process. You know, I think I've been quoted to make a statement that doing PCR and trying to identify enteric pathogens directly from stool samples is like taking a Rolls Royce in the jungle, you know, for a safari. You know, it's not an appropriate technique.
Yeah.
In epidemiology, it's not the rapid diagnosis that's important. With TB, yes, that's important. But in enterics, you know, the treatment is the same. You know, either give oral rehydration or antibiotics in invasive diarrhea. And you know, invasive diarrhea you can just tell from clinical picture. You know, fever, blood, or mucus in the stool. So you don't really need a diagnosis specific. But diagnosis is important for epidemiology. If you want to look at risk factors for a particular type of organism, like we did with Salmonella or the E. coli or the Salmonella in Brazil, we need to know the diagnosis. But that doesn't have to be gotten immediately when the patient is sick. You collect the information over time and then identify a risk factor and then change the factors that contribute. So you know, we've developed a PCR method for distinguishing E. coli pathogens, but it's still, you know, you just go through the traditional plating first, and overnight you have these colonies, then you take the colonies and do PCR and identify what those are. You know, I know my friends who've spent their entire fellowship trying to process the stool sample so that you can eliminate all the inhibitors to do PCR directly from that. That process itself took, you know, like a day, with all kinds of reagents, just to get the extract the DNA to do the PCR. Whereas with the conventional method, you know, before you go home, you take a plate, you swab it, and next morning you see these colonies, very clean. You don't have to do anything, and then you take the colonies to do the PCR. So, it's knowing, you know, what's appropriate for a particular setting, and you know, that came from my epidemiology training.
Okay.
So, just because you have molecular technology doesn't mean that that's going to replace the convention. There are many very appropriate, useful conventional techniques that could be used for epidemiology. And in combination with molecular techniques, you know, then they become very, very powerful. So you pick and choose, you know, what's most appropriate for a particular setting and a particular question you have. And so that's what we try to do. This is what I was saying earlier about how you have to incorporate what you learned in the past to do what you're doing now so that you know what's appropriate. If you just learned molecular biology, I would not have come up with this kind of approach. And it's even more fundamental than that, because if you do PCR directly from stool samples, you don't really quantitate. And in order for diarrhea to occur, you know, people have done this work in the 40s and 50s. A certain number of organisms are required to produce the clinical picture. If you don't have, you could just be colonized, you could just be infected, and you may not have an infection. Now, if you have such a sensitive technique, a PCR, and you do a stool sample analysis with PCR directly, and you come up with a positive signal, does that mean that that organism is causing the disease? Or is it because the technique is so sensitive, they're just picking it up? That person could be infected with something else, but and colonized with this other organism that the PCR picks up. You can't say for sure by PCR that that's causing the disease that you see in that person. Because by doing it the way we do it, where you isolate the colonies, you actually sample a certain number of colonies for the PCR. This is exactly what they do for the conventional. They take a certain number of colonies and then subject them to the standard biochemical analysis to identify them. So we maintain the same standard that's been already well established to be an associated characteristic for disease production. So we preserve what's already been done, you know, for decades, and yet make it quicker and cheaper because you don't have to have all these chemical reagents. When we do this in Brazil, we do it right in the field. All we need is a thermocycler. You just need electricity. And we did all kinds of things in the field to really understand the epidemiology of E. coli diarrhea, you know. So, so you know, it's a real appropriate transfer of technology. Make the technology accessible, you know, to settings that in settings, you know, where which was not possible before. So, you know, these are kind of inner revelations you have about you know molecular techniques. And to have a very good collaboration with a person over at UCSF, Eva Harris. Did you ever hear of her? So she, you know, she does exactly that. She's an appropriate transfer of technology to use. And so, we just when I moved out here, and I just happened to learn about her, and so we have a very good kind of a relationship and doing exactly this sort of thing. She's more of a lab person, PhD lab person. So she develops these techniques and sort of help to apply them in the field. And, there's a lot of interest in this kind of approach, you know, in the School of Public Health and other places. People, you know, are applying from all over the world, you know, and just trying to learn these new approaches to molecular epidemiology. And so,
And so, how did you make the transition from the intellectual transition from interesting questions, epidemiological questions of how infection is spread, how organisms run their course, to a question that really basic questions of host cell and
interaction. Well, you know, when I was doing the EPEC work, you know, I was looking at the way the E. coli attached to HeLa cells, so that was sort of the first example of how, you know, when I became interested in this interaction of the pathogen with the mammalian cell. And that was sort of the basis later for my Pew Scholars, you know, application. So, you know, after Stanford, I went to India for 2 years. So there was a break for 2 years in India where I wasn't doing any of those things. So, yeah, no, you know, there was a break for 2 years. And then I joined the faculty at Cornell and I resumed my EPEC project at that time. And so I got that going again. But also, you know, when I was in India, I became interested in TB. Actually, I was became interested in TB even at Stanford. I worked one evening a week in the Santa Clara County TB clinic. We actually did a research project looking at multi-drug resistant TB, just an epidemiological study, you know, so risk factor for MDR TB. And when I went to India, you know, I saw lots of TB, and I became really interested in the question. And that's when I became interested in applying the PCR to diagnose TB. And you know, actually, Indians—I don't know if you know—but the Indians were one of the first ones to apply PCR for TB, because I actually took the DNA of TB that I extracted at CDC before I went to India and gave that to them to work on the develop the PCR. And so they did that. And so when I came back to the States, I was still interested in doing something with TB. So I started, you know, trying to developed a PCR method for TB, and I entered a collaboration with the New York City Health Department. But then I became more and more interested in applying what I already had done with EPEC to TB and looking at the mechanism of invasion of TB into cells. And I was very lucky. You know, we made a genomic library, chop up the genes of TB and then put it into E. coli and look for an E. coli that invaded cells, and we found such a thing. And that was the basis for our science paper, identification of this gene called MCE, Mycobacterium cell entry gene. And that's blossoming into all kinds of very interesting things now, but that was our first sort of major paper in Cornell, identifying the invasion gene of TB. And so, you know, continuing to work on the mechanism of this invasion of TB. We're still doing the EPEC project, too, and that's also produced some other interesting twists on the relationship of this E. coli with the cells. So those are the two parallel sort of bench projects that we've been doing over the last almost 8 years now. Sometime in the I guess 30 year of my stay at Cornell, you know, we started a surveillance system in New York City using Cornell affiliated hospitals, where all the hospitals would send to my lab all the TB strains, and it would do genetic fingerprint analysis on them. I don't know if you have that paper.
Yeah.
Cindy Friedman is the first author. And we were looking at risk factors for so-called clonal strains of TB. And we identified a number of risk factors. And, you know, Peter Small in San Francisco did the same sort of thing. And we came out with very similar conclusions. There's certain characteristics were associated with being infected with clonal strains, meaning that they were recently infected TB. So TB, you can get active disease shortly after an infection or many, many years after an infection. So the second type of disease is called reactivation disease. So the organism is inside you for many, many years, and then for some reason it reactivates. Whereas the first type is called primary disease, and that's when you get the disease really almost immediately after an infection. So clonality tells us whether it's reactivation or primary disease. It's kind of an accepted sort of assumption that a lot of people make now. And so we're able to say for the first time that in HIV-infected people, 60% of those got disease from recent infection. So it's not reactivation. But if you do the same study in Brazil, 60% is actually reactivation disease. It's really and this is probably because in Brazil there's much more TB prevalence, so you get infected very early on in life. So they get AIDS later, then they actually reactivate the infection that they already had. Whereas here, it's a new transmission. So the person didn't have the infection to begin with. It's a new infection. But if you get the new infection, you develop disease faster because you're immunosuppressed.
Yes.
80% of the MDR, the multi-drug resistant TB in New York City, that's recent infection, which was completely unexpected. Which meant that when the organism is transmitted to a new person, it's already resistant. So traditionally, it was felt that because you're not taking the drugs properly or because the physicians are not giving the drugs properly, the person who is initially infected with a drug-sensitive strain becomes resistant in the same person. That's not the case in New York City. The organism is already resistant when it goes to a new person, which was, you know, very important because it's a totally different approach to intervention if one or the other. And so by just having that information, New York City Health Department could make, you know, a new policy about intervention. And that's when they started directly observed therapy. You know, I mean, they were doing that regardless of our work, but it justified that kind of approach to intervention. But anyway, I guess to answer your question, in the process of doing that study, we also discovered certain clones to be predominant in New York City. It's very interesting. And there's one strain that was called, we called it C strain. It was a drug susceptible strain. It was not a drug resistant strain. And we didn't know why it was all over the city. And so we did a long, you know, term study, and eventually found an association with intravenous drug users. 50% of the TB patients who had this particular strain were intravenous drug users. So then we said, you know, why intravenous drug users? You know, they're not all going to the same, you know, place to get to shoot themselves up. I mean, they're all over the city. And they're also non-IV drug users. The 50% are obviously non-drug users. And they're all over the city, HIV positive, negatives, women, men, all ethnic groups. So there's no particular pattern except that, you know, a large percent were IV drug users. In the meantime, we're doing parallel studies of in the lab of the susceptibility of these strains to all kinds of stress conditions in the macrophage that they might encounter in a macrophage. And one of the conditions is nitric oxide, exposure to nitric oxide. It turns out this particular strain was resistant, completely resistant to nitric oxide, whereas all the others were killed. So why the association between nitric oxide resistance and IV drug use? And it took us a while to really come up with the hypothesis. And we eventually hypothesized that intravenous drug users are constantly injecting themselves with all kinds of antigens, so they're stimulating their macrophages to make low levels of nitric oxide. So they get infected with TB. They eventually will select for nitric oxide resistant strain. So it's the host that's making its own drugs that then eventually select for the resistance genes. It's like a natural selection. As opposed to, you know, when you take drugs improperly, you, of course, select for the resistance strain. In this case, your own body is making the drug because you're an intravenous drug user. So if that resistance strain infects a non-drug user, it's more likely to cause active disease faster than other strains that are not resistant. So the primary disease occurrence is much faster or more likely. I think somebody's calling. Now, to make the long story short, we found this particular strain to be resistant to nitric oxide, and we went off to clone the gene that made it resistant to nitric oxide, and that just came out a couple months ago. Jack Smith. Okay. I don't know if you have that paper.
Yeah.
So this is the first example where we identified a gene that was responsible for its widespread dissemination in a city based on our original epidemiological work. And this is sort of the new kind of a trend in my lab to really understand the molecular basis for disease transmission in a community. And this is what's really getting to what I call real molecular epidemiology, that we really believe that every pathogen has a molecular basis for its epidemiological behavior. You know, if you think about it, every infectious agent is transmitted by its own unique process, and it has its own unique epidemiology. Salmonella typhimurium is only, you know, found in in mammals, you know, infections. It's associated with food and it causes diarrhea. Why? TB causes disease in the lungs and is transmitted from lungs by airborne route. HIV transmitted either by blood products or, you know, by sex. You know, every pathogen has its own unique way of transmitting to other persons, and also, you know, communicable agents are there not to cause disease in a single individual host. It's there to sustain itself, you know, to maintain its population, a community of hosts. So its target is not an individual host, but the community. And there's a molecular basis for that. So if we can understand the molecular basis for that, then we can really get at the vulnerable aspect of the organism and really control the disease. If you just focus on a single host, you just never get at the important genes. It's really the genes that contribute to its transmission in the community that really makes a pathogen a true pathogen. And so that's where our research is now leading to. This example of the nitric oxide, you know, resistant gene is something that came from this big epidemiology project that we did. Which is much more satisfying than, you know, identifying some interesting gene at the bench and then trying to, you know, spend your entire lifetime working on this gene and then saying, is this relevant, you know, to the real world?
And why is that more interesting for you? Because that's how many batch scientists, and I would argue that most Pew scholars that I've interviewed,
that's what they do.
Yep. Do and that's the groovy. That's the groovy science, right? Now, the sexy science that gets you published in the big journal Science, Cell, and, Nature is to identify this gene and then maybe contemplate its significance later.
Right.
And so why is it you, and you stand out among the scholars that you look at it?
The other way around.
Yeah,
because, you know, you already know from the beginning that this is going to be relevant, whatever you discover, because you start with epidemiology. For you start up with relevant information first, and then narrow towards the gene. And so, for me, that's much more satisfying, because you already know ahead of time that it's going to be important, instead of waiting years to find out whether it's important or not. I mean, it's interesting, you know, from basic science point of view, it's interesting to work on a particular gene that explains the mechanism, the physiology, or the, you know, basic molecular biology. And it's very important. You know, I'm not criticizing those things. I mean, and they're, you know, obviously people who should be doing those things. But that's not my background. You know. And the people who do those things then have the background to really be able to say ultimately whether that's going to be important for some big picture purpose or not. I mean, that's not what they're doing those things for anyways. You know, they're really interested in really understanding the mechanisms and how that information might eventually become a chapter in a textbook. I mean, that's, you know, that is an important goal, you know, to perpetuate knowledge, science, information. And it's a noble goal, and I'm not criticizing it. But that's not my interest. Just not happen. You know, it is my interest. So you can do the same thing. You know, you can still identify a very interesting gene in the way I do it. It may take a longer time to get to that, but you can still then study that gene and the gene product and do everything that the other Pew scholars are doing. So I still get to do the thing, you know, the same thing, but eat the pie at the same time. So it's much more fun. And that's why I'm in the School of Public Health as opposed to the Molecular and Cell Biology Department.
Okay.
I mean, I came here because this is where I wanted to be. And, you know, it introduces a new discipline called molecular epidemiology that, you know, is where you still can, you know, you get to do pathogenesis work, but at the same time, the pathogenesis work, you know, may lead to some you know, new discoveries that's going to have relevance or impact in public health. And, you know, I'm doing this because I'm interested in public health, not because, you know, I want to have something put into a textbook someday. One of the favorite or commonly used expressions here when I first came to Berkeley was, you know, I mean, I go on these search committees and things and, you know, interview candidates, and one of the things that committee members often ask is, you know, is the work that this person is doing, you know, going to lead to a chapter in a textbook someday? And, you know, I hear this so often, and I guess obviously for some people these things are very important, but, you know, I don't want that to be just the final, you know, goal of the work that I do. If it doesn't end up in a chapter, that's fine with me, as long as it makes an impact, you know, somewhere out in the world, in the real world, you know, that's what I'm interested in.
And so that impact is?
Well, coming up with a product that's based on our, you know, basic science work, such as a new vaccine or new drugs, or that then can be used, or a new diagnostic test that will make a difference in, you know, out in the world we're working in Brazil and other places. So, excuse me. And it just, you never know how these things, you know, where these things lead to. This invasion protein that we cloned, we eventually identified a very short segment, just 22 amino acids, that has this invasion activity. So we made a plasmid incorporating this peptide sequence, DNA that encodes this peptide sequence. And so we made this expression plasmid in such a way that every piece of DNA fragment that we clone will express a fusion protein with this 22 amino acid at the N-terminus, which means that any protein with this at the N-terminus will go into cells Okay, so we started a new project to develop a salmonella vaccine. You know, I don't know if you know, but salmonella enteritidis, which is one of the serotypes of salmonella, is the most important cause of salmonellosis in the U.S. You know, very high morbidity and even deaths, you know, occur. Mm-hmm. And 80% of the infections probably come from chickens, poultry products. So we want to make a vaccine to be given to chickens, to interrupt the transmission from chickens to humans. excuse me. So how do you administer a vaccine to chickens? Well, you can't give it, you know, by injection every chicken. It would just be economically unfeasible. So you have to put it into a feed. Mm-hmm. No, so if you put it into a feed, then it has to be absorbed orally. So I'm going to make a chicken vaccine with these proteins that will have this peptide sequence and N-terminus. So when you put it into the chicken feed, then you'll be absorbed, be taken up into the cells, and then, you know, maybe elicit mucosal immune response or, you know, whatever immune response you may elicit. But instead of testing one protein at a time, this gives us an opportunity to test the entire genome of the organism. And you chop up the genome, all these fragments, and express every possible protein that a salmonella can make. And then just pack them together, put them into the chicken feed, divide them up in subsets, and then identify which subset protects. And you keep narrowing it down until you come up with a set that's most protective. That's where you can screen the entire genome of an organism to come up with the right set of protective proteins. So that you don't have to spend, you know, several years of your life trying to see if one protein that you happen to have is going to be protective or not. So this is a completely unexpected, unplanned application of a discovery made about working with a TB. And, you know, this is what's fun about science. But this is also what I mean by being able to, you know, study the genetics, the sort of mechanisms to understand these things. And then again, then transfer that to an application. And, you know, for me, that's a lot more fun than, you know, crystallizing, you know, a protein to see how its conformation relates to some mechanism in intracellular process. That itself is intellectually interesting too, yeah, for me, of course. But there's something else that's even more interesting than that for me. So. That's why I do it the way I do it.
Okay, and one last question, and I think we can stop for today. And so, in your view, what is the better means to the scientific end?
Oh, I don't think there's any better means. I mean, I think, okay. Yeah, I know. I think they're all different means, and I think you should, you know, certainly do different means to get to the scientific question at hand. Now, certainly the more traditional approach is much more efficient, you know, because you're really focused on those issues and spending all your time, you know, doing that. And, you know, my method is a little more sort of roundabout way to get to the same point. So it takes a longer time, but when you get to the point, you can go back to why you did this thing in the first place much more quickly. So, I think both approaches are necessary, because you never know what you end up getting. You know. But I just feel that I have to justify all my previous training, so that's why I do it the way I do it.
Okay. I think we're at a good place to stop.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.